But you all are all greats in the business. Robert De Niro, Leonardo DiCaprio, Martin Scorsese. But do you have a moment when the three of you are together that you look at each other and say, holy bleep, look at us.
There was one moment at Cannes at the Hotel du Cap after the film was shown. Oh. And we went up and they gave us, had a drink, and Bob just looked up at the sky and we were looking up and there were all these beams of light like spotlights. And he said, would you believe from where we came from? We're here now tonight? I said, yeah. I said, it's amazing. It's extraordinary. And we just rested for that one time. That's very, very rare between us.
Yeah, just to take it in.
We took it in, and yeah. It wasn't congratulatory. It was just like,
yes.
Wow,
yeah.
What a journey.
Good morning, and welcome to Lopes on Movies. My name is Joey Lopes, and today I am joined by Connor.
Good morning.
And I'm joined by Mark.
Hello.
What a day. What a day, gentlemen.
Oh,
isn't
yes.
this just a lovely night to be talking about movies?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, I mean, it's good, as good as any.
Yeah, but this is a special occasion. Like,
no, it is.
I'm not getting the excitement from you guys.
Oh, gosh. I've been wanting to talk about this movie for a while. And it's one of those things that the more time goes by, like I saw it probably, no, when did I see it? I saw it on Saturday. So every day has kind of, it hasn't left my mind yet.
No, absolutely. I mean, well, we've been talking about wanting to see this movie for a long time that we're going to talk about on the show today. And there's no point in keeping it a secret, mm-hmm. really. We're talking about the new Martin Scorsese movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. It's no secret that we are all big Marty heads. We love Marty. You know, what would we do without him? He's the one true hero of the cinema. He's the guy who tells it like it is. And one of the great artists of our time. So, like, at any time he releases a new movie, it's always a special occasion, always a special event. And so, of course, this one was one we were all very, very heavily anticipating. I remember the last time the three of us talked about a Martin Scorsese movie. I don't think that Mark was here when we talked about the art.
I could have sworn I was here for The Irishman.
Were you here for The Irishman? I can't remember if you were here for The Irishman.
I definitely saw it, so...
Yeah, obviously you saw it.
I do remember... I talked about it with you.
On our old show, we all talked about Silence.
Yes.
And I just want to, like, quickly point out, can we just, like, talk about the last, like, decade or so of Martin Scorsese's career and how insane it's been? Like, you got Wolf of Wall Street into Silence, into The Irishman... into this and multiple other like documentaries and stuff in between then. Like, when did you do the George Harrison documentary, actually?
Living I thought in the that was during world. This era, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, that was 2011, so that was right before Wolf of Wall Street. So this man is just not only incredibly prolific at his age, but is still creating absolutely tremendous work. Actually, it's something I just saw not long ago, because Connor, you had linked to this Associated Press interview that Martin Scorsese did. They asked him about that Quentin Tarantino thing, or Quentin Tarantino is all about, like, you know, I'm only going to make 10 movies. I don't want my movies to start getting bad when I get old, right? And he always claims that there are these filmmakers who kept making movies into old age, who started making worse movies or whatever. Like, this is Quentin Tarantino's claim. And they asked Scorsese about it. He was like, I don't know. It's not really. It's a different thing. And I think they actually literally asked him, "Are you built different than Tarantino?" And he said, "I am." He said, "Yeah, he's a writer. I'm a director. It's a different thing."
Yeah, I guess there is something to that where he did say that he's a writer director, which does change it. And
it does change it. It is different.
Yeah, and Marty is purely a director. Like, he finds a script and he works the script, of course, but. That is his, you know, that is Marty.
I think still, it's just like, a mythos thing with Tarantino, though. He just wants
I think he's out of his mind.
Be like, that guy.
No, he absolutely is. What I think he said he's just going to move over to like TV. Like, he keeps giving himself these
as
outs.
If that counts.
Yeah,
as
exactly. He's like, oh well, you know, oh well, I could do TV though. I could do TV. You know,
that doesn't count.
That's how Tarantino kind of says it. When he's like, I mean, I could still do TV, or I could do theater. Like, that's That's my Quentin.
That's a good, that's actually a good impression.
It's not a bad Tarantino, actually. Yeah. You got a lot of his mannerisms there.
I can hear your hand movements.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it's just funny because, like, the thing with Scorsese, what he said was basically like, you know, I still have things that I'm curious about, and there's still stuff I want to do, so I'm going to do it. And that's also what Paul Thomas Anderson has said. I want to do this for as long as I can.
You know? I mean, like, I buy into the idea that you get better and better at your craft as you hone it into, like, I mean, we were looking at this before this movie came out a while back, where Scorsese, like many other masters of the medium, talk about how they only feel like in their older ages, they're discovering what cinema can do.
Yeah, that was like a classic Kurosawa years. Quote that he said at the Academy Awards or something. And yeah, that's and Kurosawa made a lot of incredible movies in his in the end of his years. I mean, both Kagemusha and Vron are you know, obviously some of the greatest movies that he made. Even if his,
I think directors only really get better.
Yeah, I mean, there's just. Well, if you're an artist, you always have
maybe
something
not
to do.
Perfect, but I mean, like,
I'd say
your 50s, you're still honing it at
maybe,
minimum.
Maybe. Yeah. So here's the thing: there's different tiers for sure. And we were talking before about how you put Marty, you put Kurosawa, you put Hitchcock, like these like titans at the top. But there are directors who were great for a while who, for whatever reason, their movies after just haven't like think. Francis Ford Coppola, like
yeah, I
like
was thinking yeah.
his movies have not or like we just watched Suspiria, like some of Dario Argento, like his latest movies are like Dracula 3D or something, like it's it's just not the same body of work later on.
I just feel like by and large, unless you run out of things to say or have lost it in some fashion, artists tend to continue to say, like, Lynch is another good example.
That's very true.
Yeah. Like, there's plenty of art. I'd say by and large the later years can be extremely interesting for artists. I don't know, maybe not all, obviously,
maybe not all, but like, why,
but
what are you so
I would
concerned
be interested
about
in seeing it more than not, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, and even if Tarantino makes a bunch of movies that suck in his old age, like, you know, no, nobody is like really that upset that Hitchcock's last movie was Family Plot, you know, because he still made like 100 incredible movies. So like, who cares? Like, your legacy is secure, dude. Like, so I don't know. It just seems stupid to me, especially when you have movies like Killers of the Flower Moon coming out, demonstrating very clearly that you can be an incredible filmmaker at your old age, and possibly in a lot of, maybe even a wiser filmmaker in some ways, just because of having been around for so long and trying to tackle different kinds of stories. But anyway, let's start talking about Killers of the Flower Moon, because there's a lot to go into with this movie.
Yeah.
So Connor, can you give us a little bit of a synopsis of this one?
I can. So Killers of the Flower Moon, directed obviously by Martin Scorsese, written by Eric Roth, Martin Scorsese, and based on the novel by David Gran. I believe it was called, Killers of the Flower Moon. Hold on, let me actually get the full title, because it's really a different story. It's Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. So it's and I think we could maybe go into a little bit of how the book is fairly different from the film that was made and the different script iterations that happened. Synopsis: when oil is discovered in 1920s Oklahoma under Osage Nation land, the Osage people are murdered one by one until the FBI steps in to unravel the mystery. So that is what happens. But at its heart, this is there is a deep love story here. Where that is about a kind of drifter character. A bit of a dim bulb person that we will certainly get into, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who is kind of he's a big time follower of this guy, and kind of follows what his uncle's advice, played by Robert De Niro, to marry into an Osage family so that he could get the head rights and eventually just get the rights to the land back into, you know, the you know, white settler family or colonizer kind of thing, to get the land. What makes it so interesting is that there really is a love story there. It sounds like it's just being, you know, he's just using the people, but there is something here at the grand scale that there is a love story, but also he's being controlled by his pure evil uncle.
I wanted to put it was, it's definitely the first love story I've seen that tops Phantom Thread for how messed up it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I think the story is really not that different from a lot of other, like structurally it's similar to what Scorsese does a lot, which is basically exploring like profoundly evil organizations from the perspective of like one member of that organization. Mm-hmm. So that in this case, the member that we're following for most of the movie is the Leonardo DiCaprio character, Ernest, which is the character Connor's talking about, this main character. And it is similar to the Irishman. This character is basically like a pawn. He's lowest rung on the ladder of this organization. In some ways, like seeing it from his perspective is what makes the movie so unbelievably horrifying, because he himself is like, he's almost too dumb to be like himself pure evil, and yet everything he does in the movie is pure evil. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're trying to like understand this guy, like how can he do all of these awful things that have such an unbelievably horrible effect on his wife and the people around him, and lie and be what he is, but also still believe that he has this genuine love for his wife, which he does, and that's what makes it so scary, because it's much easier. Like if this was just a movie about a guy who is, you know, tricking his wife to get the head rights, and he's just basically like he's aware of his evil, then that's like he's just a bad guy, and it's very easy for you to just like write him off as like a sociopath or whatever. But what this is suggesting is that some of like the worst evil out there can be entangled with like real human emotion, which is a much harder thing to accept, a much scarier thing to accept about the world.
And I think it's worth pointing out that that wasn't in the book, but there was a lot of research done in the background of this movie talking to people from this family.
Yes,
that
right.
Confirmed that the way, maybe not obviously it's a movie, but the core of the story that they were in love with each other actually is like true. It was
that came confirmed from Marty's research talking with the Osage people. Yeah,
it changed entirely. So the you know, the novel has that, you know, second title, I guess, that it's the birth of the FBI. The novel is from the perspective of the FBI. So it's more of like an investigation. It's not nearly the same story. So I think it was actually Leo and Marty that were kind of scoping this project. And when they did those conversations with the Osage people, and found out this story and then changed it and made Ernest the main character, along with Lily Gladstone, who plays Molly, who is, you know, his wife, who does have Native American descent, and, you know, is playing, well, his wife, who is an Osage. It changed the entire complexion of the story, and they could, it's much more interesting that way. And then you're right, Joey, it's like a classic Marty character, which is he has that gray area. He definitely does lean into he's doing pure evil things.
Oh,
but
he's an irredeemable.
Right,
he's irredeemable, but the fact that he's like, the fact that you can see some humanity in him is what makes him so scary.
Yeah.
Because even though he is an unbelievably irredeemable monster, it's because there's some element of him that you can recognize as human that makes him so horrifying.
Well, I think that's why you can't look at, like, it makes Molly even more sympathetic, because it's like he genuinely loves her. There's no one, she's not getting tricked. She's just like a part of the scheme without even knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
And like the man is showing genuine concern for her as he's killing her family members
and poisoning her. Like he's unbelievable. Like you can, that's the thing that's so like It makes this is a very heavy movie. Like the thing that I think is like that Scorsese, especially in this period of his career, when you compare it to like The Irishman, is he has this like this way of showing violence in such a casual and matter of fact manner that makes it really, really frightening. Especially because like in this movie, you're getting the perspective of the bad guys basically from the very beginning, and there's no mystery about what's going on, right? Like I'm pretty sure that the book is structured more as a mystery where you don't know exactly what the situation is in the book until you read through it and you learn who the bad guys are, you learn what's going on, right? Like it's almost structured in that way. Whereas in this, you know instantly what's going on. Like there's, and the characters just talk about it practically openly. Mm-hmm. Like they're so casual about the atrocities that they're committing here that you can't believe it. You can't believe how horrifying it is.
And then
also,
when they're shown, it's all hard cuts.
Yeah, it's just matter of fact. It's just there it is.
There's no build up.
You know?
Like,
exactly.
It's literally just, like, shot, bam. Like, somebody's getting blasted through the head or something.
And the weird way about it, too, is that they are all, like, the way, especially the De Niro's character, who, this is the guy who's pure evil, which is William
Incredible
King Hale.
Incredible
performance.
Oh, yeah. Just, yeah, yeah. Like, the fact that he's saying all these things, it's basically like, oh, these people, they're going to go away. They're, you know, they're not, their time is going to go. And then trust me, I love them too, but we need to make sure this comes to us. You know, like it's,
yeah,
he has this. And because Leo's character, Ernest, you know, the character in the film is such a, I said, like a dim bulb. Like he's just not a very bright person.
Not a lot there.
Is just, it's almost like whatever person talks to him last is what he thinks he has to do, you know, regardless of his feelings.
A little bit, yeah.
And that happens throughout this movie. And his uncle, like this De Niro's character, William Hale, has such an influence over him no matter what, even though he knows it's completely opposite of what he actually feels in his soul. It's so interesting.
Yeah, it really is. But yeah, I mean, this is just a peak De Niro performance too.
It's like incredible.
So just talk about the performances in general from the three leads. Like De Niro as the villain of this movie, like there's a part like really like very, very early on where him and Ernest are having a conversation, and he just does that like classic De Niro smile where he's like laughing, and like his face has this very particular look to it that reminded me so much of like similar smiles he gives in like Taxi Driver and like the classic De Niro movies. It just reminded me like we're watching a real Robert De Niro performance here, you know, like he gives everything for his Martin Scorsese performances. And it's so funny because it's like it's either that or like the worst comedy movie you've never heard of.
About My Father?
You
don't think
doing,
he put in top effort in About My Father?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think he gives it all for Sebastian Maniscalco in the same way he does for Martin Scorsese. but I mean, it's just an absolutely monstrous performance. Like he is so frightening in this movie. And then there's Leo who. I think there's something very brave about how Leo, like when they were developing this movie, and the original idea of the movie was probably having Leo play the FBI investigator.
It was,
And eventually Leo just kind of said like, well, they analyzed the thing and they're like, well, so what is the heart of this story? And they both, like him and Scorsese both kind of concluded, well, it's really the relationship between Ernest and Molly. So Leo was like, well, I should play Ernest then. And so he's willingly deciding to play like the dumbest, most despicable person ever. And I really think that there's something special about the way that Leo plays these like not a lot of thoughts in the head type characters.
Yes.
There's something similar with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like his character in that is not quite as stupid, but he's also like kind of like this not all together. Yeah. And I think he's just very good at it.
Yeah, this is his prime spot. Like I have not liked Leo in a lot of things prior to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I find like some other people that his performances are showy, he just gets angry. But I feel like when he's playing these characters in particular, and I completely agree with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, there's just the performance feels more real. Like especially this one, he has like a his face looks different in this movie. He has like a constant, like weathered, like grimace on his face the entire time.
Yeah,
even when he's smiling, his face looks completely different. And like, I almost thought that the accent was bad, just like looking at the watching the initial trailers, and I was like, ah, it's a bad Leo accent, but I love it. But it grows on you, and it fits. It fits so well. Like, you can clearly, this is a character who has been through a lot in life and is just like, I'm going to just do whatever they say, and I'm going to do what's in it for me, and wherever the wind blows is what he's going to do. It's a perfect performance, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. And then, of course, Lily Gladstone as Molly is phenomenal performance. Like, there's so much, like, there's a lot of mystery in her character because you're never entirely sure what she knows and when and how much she's, like, willing to go along with. Because there's a sense that, like, she's sort of aware of what's happening, but
yeah, she has to
doesn't
know
really
on
want to
some
admit it,
level that,
you know,
stuff's going
yeah,
on.
But it's the way that she just kind of, like, carries herself is very, very interesting. And it's a phenomenal performance.
Yeah, I mean, she's the moral center of the film that grounds all this stuff back. Like, after, like, Ernest and Bill Hale and all the other characters that are doing these horrible things, when it comes back to home and you just see, like, Ernest go back to his home and acting like it's just a regular family situation, and you just see how it is affecting her and all her family is getting, you know, killed. It's absolutely devastating to see the swings that she goes through, and it's a tremendous performance. It really is.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And there's just so many things in this that are like it just from the performance perspective and the actors, like, there's so many interesting actors in this movie that give, like, small performances that are extremely memorable. Like, just interesting faces, you know, like, he cast some very interesting people.
All of the people that are involved as, like, bit part killers really stood out as just,
yeah,
like,
exactly,
fantastic.
Right? They're all fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, just thinking about that guy, A.C. Kirby, the guy who played A.C. Kirby, like, what a weird face that guy has. Just an interesting, like, look to him. There's the guy whose name is literally Lewis Cancel Me, who was also in The Irishman. He played the guy with the big glasses who kind of assists in the plan to take out Jimmy Hoffa. Do you remember that guy? He was also in this. He played a guy who was, like, just kind of maybe one of the more horrifying characters in the movie, just because he is a pure sociopath, like, in like such a deadpan and, like, frightening way. In this, just another bit part, but, like, there's so many bit parts like that are phenomenal. Like, there's so many interesting faces. Like, it really does, like and just the general production design of this 1920s setting is just so perfectly realized. I mean
like, it's a 3.5 hour movie, but it doesn't feel its, like, length at all. It just glides along. It's incredible. I think that's one thing that it always strikes me about Marty movies is that he doesn't do necessarily flashy things in and of themselves, or, like, experiment as much. He's just,
especially
such,
late in his career, like,
exactly,
he did a lot of, like, fancy camera stuff in a lot of his early
career, Taxi Driver, for instance, like, he's such a perfectionist, and he's so good at designing these movies that they feel like I don't know how to say it's just a master at work in such a way that it's hard to notice the work that he's doing. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, one of those things that's just, like, so, just so, that, like, a magic trick, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say this will be tough for some people, I would say, to be, 3.5 hours is a long time to be
in. It's a big commitment at any point.
In a theater. Yeah. And I think that the fact that this movie's going to be released, I guess, on Apple TV, I think it would play differently from a theater compared to watching at home. But I think that this movie was made with that in mind, that because you could definitely shorten this. Like,
really easily. There are really obvious breaking points. Like, I mean, one of the most blatant ones is right before the FBI shows up, or right after, because it's practically a different movie at that point.
True.
And it still has a, like, movie length of runtime afterwards. So I could see it working in both ways. I wonder if he shot it knowing that people. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, he almost said you've sat in front of a TV watching a TV show start to end or something akin to that before this movie when he was asked about the runtime.
Right. So, yes. The other thing I would bring up is the music, the score.
Yeah, I was going to say the Robbie Robertson score, yeah. Which is a shame because Robbie Robertson just passed away, like not very long ago. And he was a very close collaborator with Scorsese for a long time. Of course, Robbie Robertson was most famous for being in The Band, which Martin Scorsese made a documentary about, the Last Waltz, which many people consider to be among, if not the best concert film of all time. So they have a very, very long working relationship between those two. And yeah, this was the last one. So it's kind of sad, but very evocative score.
Yeah, this score in particular, that bass line that's like going like the entire time.
Yeah. It's great.
It's fantastic. The tension and the unease that you just feel through like a lot of it is, I don't know. It's great. There's a mood to this movie. Like, because absolutely, you're watching something that you're mortified by what you're seeing throughout a lot of it. You're uncomfortable, yeah, because unlike a lot of other Scorsese movies where you're kind of part of the fun and it kind of it's kind of a criticism of him by some.
Yeah, but I mean, who wouldn't want to be a part of the stuff going on in Wolf of Wall Street?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that it glorifies like the mafia or things like that.
Okay, so the whole point of that, and the thing that I think that makes Martin Scorsese such a great filmmaker, is that he takes the audience seriously and really asks them to like examine the relationship between themselves and the material that they're watching, right? Like the whole point of his of something like The Wolf of Wall Street, especially like the last shot in The Wolf of Wall Street, is showing all of the people in the crowd just gawking at this Jordan Belfort character, like trying to learn from him. Mm-hmm. And you see all these people, it's a reflection of the audience because we all just went through this experience and there were aspects of the stuff that we just watched that seemed enticing. But ultimately, it's like we're being led on by this monster because Jordan Belfort is very clearly portrayed as a horrible man. Right? Now, in this movie, it's not the same thing in that sense because there's nothing about the organization that we're watching that is enticing to us, right? Like everything about this organization that we follow in this movie is pure evil and we feel it that way. But it is a part of real American history and real, like they're an outgrowth of American expansion and American colonialism. It's important for us to recognize that and recognize what that means to us as an audience watching it as well. Like Martin Scorsese, even, like, I don't want to spoil anything about the ending because the ending is very, very bold in this movie.
Yes, for sure.
But the whole point of that ending, and I don't want to oversimplify it because the ending is there's a lot you could draw from it, but I think the point is that he's getting us to like think about our relationship to the story as well as his own as the filmmaker, and pointing out how like for a large part of the history of this story, it was treated basically as like a curiosity instead of as the extremely dark chapter in American history that it is, and how important it is that we recognize it as such. And so much of Martin Scorsese movies are about that, about asking the audience to think critically about their relationship to this material and what that should mean for them.
He's doing it through inverting it, because obviously not everybody's seen it, but via almost parodying the opposite reaction, he's telling you the message that he just said.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think this movie is fantastic. I don't know what else you could say.
No, absolutely.
No, he just keeps hitting the home runs, Marty.
Cutting them home runs.
we've, you know, it's really, really a special movie, I think. So definitely, if you have the opportunity to go check it out, I would highly recommend it, just as not only another masterwork from the greatest living filmmaker, but also just like an important story and an important episode in American history that's not talked about very often. And I think this movie does a very, very good job showing you the depths of evil that led to it. And being aware of that can be useful for a person, I think.
I think so.
So, yeah, you know, it's just another masterpiece. Loved it.